Way back when I was thinking about starting a high-ticket dropshipping business, the one thing I was looking for was someone to show me what one of these sites looks like. So John and I have done that for you at dropshipbreakthrough.com/go. So head to dropshipbreakthrough.com/go and watch the free training.
Welcome to the Dropship Podcast, where you'll learn how to build and grow a high-ticket dropshipping business and hear stories from successful e-commerce entrepreneurs. Let's kick this thing off.
Hey, welcome to the Dropship Podcast. John here with a solo episode for you today. Today we're catching a Q&A session that I did live a short time ago in our Facebook groups and in our YouTube channel. Of course, if you'd like to head over and check either of those things out, the links are below in the description for this show. But I answered a range of questions about high-ticket dropshipping, about dropshipping, things like Google Ads-related questions. We talked about suppliers. We talked about quizzes. We talked about what I do, what my day looks like. We talked about a whole bunch of stuff. These episodes are always very popular. I think we covered a lot of ground. Probably some mindset stuff in there as well, I think. And so, if you would like to ask any questions yourself, you're listening into the show here on Spotify maybe or Apple Podcasts. If you're on Spotify, you'll see there's a little Q&A down the page a bit where you can add in your questions. Ben and I are always looking for topics or things we can talk about on the Dropship Podcast that you'd actually like to hear us talk about as our valued audience. So please, if you've got a question and you're on Spotify, fill in the little questionnaire, leave a question, leave a topic that you'd love to hear us address or talk about, and we'll absolutely do that. Likewise, if you're seeing this video of this episode on YouTube, just leave a comment, something you'd like us to talk about in the future, something that's on your mind, questions you have about running a business, doing drop shipping, whatever it might be, leave a comment, and we'll add it to the list and definitely get to it in an upcoming episode. But for now, let's dive into the recorded Q&A session. I hope you enjoy it. I'll see you at the end. So the first question today came from Cassie. Thank you for the question. Do you recommend doing private label for products in your niche after you have gained traction? And if so, how do you get started? That's a good question. I like this question. I like the thinking. Certainly, you know, some of the avenues that open up to you as you build and grow a high-ticket dropshipping business are to start putting your brand on products, whether they are private labeled products or products that you've had developed for your business or some version of that. There are definitely options there. And I think it's something that a lot of people could probably explore earlier than they do. We had a fantastic talk at Dropship Breakthrough Live from Gian and Carsten. Shout out to them from Costa Rica. And they actually went in and private labeled their high ticket product in their niche very early on in the piece, like right at very close to the start of their business, not right at the start, but pretty close. And they've been doing that for a number of years now. They gave a fantastic talk. So it was good to hear those guys talk about that. So people do it with high ticket dropshipping, but like I say, I think a lot of people sleep on this a little bit. Because it is something that you can do at any point in time, really. But as to Cassie's question, yes, you do want to have some traction. And I think there's a couple of parts to this. So private labeling, probably just defining that a little bit. Private labeling means putting your brand on an existing product, like just taking an off-the-shelf product and you're just branding it. It's not a developed for you from scratch kind of product. It's a product that exists. You're just putting your brand on it. Then you're getting it in bulk. You're warehousing it and you're shipping it out to customers as it goes. I suppose you could drop ship private labeled products as well. But generally speaking, when people think of this, they're thinking of, you know, putting some products in a warehouse somewhere and you're getting better margins by doing so and all of that sort of thing. And that's part of the real attraction for it. Not only do you get to put your brand on something, but you should be accessing better margins for products that you're already selling. And so your business can become therefore more profitable. You then have more money to invest back into marketing to feed that to really fuel your business and grow it bigger and bigger. So private labeling, that's private labeling. It's a little bit different to developing your own product. Private labeling implies generally that you're not making any changes to the product. It's just as it is, your branding's just going on it. The next step is actually getting products developed or changing existing products to improve them. That's a slightly different thing once again. Now, there's a couple of parts to this. One is obviously sourcing the products. And the other one is like storing and then fulfilling the products. And so I think there's quite a bit to get your head around there. I think for a lot of people, there's actually a step before private labeling or developing your own product. And that is actually just buying the products from your brands that you're already selling in bulk and putting them in a warehouse somewhere and negotiating better rates for doing so. And I think that's something that people could do earlier as well. And possibly you might even do that as a step before private labeling or developing your own products. It's just getting used to the act of purchasing a larger group of products at once, putting them in a warehouse somewhere, and I'll get to that in a moment. Like getting your head around that with existing products just from the brands that you're already selling, I think is a good way to get in the practice of managing your own warehousing or buying things in bulk before you take then the step of private labeling or getting your product developed. So for a lot of people, once again, I mean, if you've sold, and you, once again, this is something you can do much earlier. If you've sold a product, the same product 5 times or 10 times in your business, guess what? You're going to sell it 5 more times or 10 more times again, right? I mean, I know a lot of people worry that, oh, I've done it, but what if it never happens again for me, what I've done? Yeah, that generally doesn't really actually happen. And so, you know, if you've sold the same product 10 times, and I'm just picking a number out of the air, that's not necessarily the number. I don't know that there is a number. But if you've sold a product 10 times in 3 months, right, there is no reason, unless your niche has seasonality, there's no reason to suggest that you're not going to sell 10 more of those in the next 3 months. So could you go out and buy 10 of them, right, from a supplier, negotiate a better rate for doing so from them, and put them in a warehouse somewhere, get better margins. And then so the next time you sell the next 10 of those, you're more profitable. Now, obviously, it requires a bit of upfront capital to do that. And there's different ways that you could source upfront capital to do something. I'm not going to go too deep into that. But there are various ways that you can do that. It'll depend a little bit on what country you're in as well, of course. Hey, if you've been thinking about starting your high ticket dropshipping journey with us here at Dropship Breakthrough, but you've got questions, you're unsure about what's inside the course, you're unsure if it's right for you, or you just love to hear from the experience of our students, you can jump on a free call right now with a member of our team who is also a Dropship Breakthrough student and successful high ticket dropshipper to talk about all of those things. Just head to dropshipbreakthrough.com/call and book your call today. But I think that's a good way to get into it. So with warehousing, you've got two options. I mean, you can either get your own space somewhere to store products, there's some upsides to doing that. Like I'm sitting here right now, this office that you see me in all the time where I record the podcast episodes and everything, this is just an office that was built inside a little, what would be considered a small warehouse. Here in Australia, and I rent this small warehouse at the moment. It doesn't have many products in it at all. I got it primarily because I wanted to build an office space that I could make and look the way I want it and all of that sort of thing. So you can go out and do that. The cost is not exorbitant, I'll be honest. You can find a lot of cheap warehouse space if you want to rent your own. There is a bit of a time commitment there because you're going to have a commercial lease. They tend to be longer than, say, residential leases and that sort of thing. But once again, you can work out all sorts of different stuff. They're much more negotiable than residential leases as well in general. So that's one option. The other option, though, is to work with a 3PL, so a third-party logistics company who will handle the warehousing for you and the fulfillment and all of that sort of thing. And if you're in the US, certainly we have a recommendation there, shipmn.com. Get in touch with Jesse there and say that Ben sent you, Ben Knegendorf. We've got a good relationship with them. Ben uses them. They're sort of Midwest, and so they're in an okay location. So that's a recommendation for the US. If you need a recommendation in any other country, reach out to me. I can probably help you with that. But a 3PL, once again, lets you take advantage of warehousing and buying things on bulk without actually having to secure something of your own, like your own little commercial property or something like that. So once again, much easier. They're going to charge you a storage fee. It can vary. You can shop around. Different 3PLs will have different rates. You can find what works for you. They'll handle returns. You know, oftentimes they'll handle, you know, little requests you might have around packaging or putting inserts in packaging and all this sort of thing. So they're pretty good, right? Generally speaking, if you find a good one, it can be a great thing. So whether you're private labeling, buying in bulk or whatever, you need to answer the question of storage, right? So think about whether you want your own or you want a 3PL. That's one of the things you have to answer either way. For most people, a 3PL might be the way to go. Now, if we're talking about private label as per the question, like how do you get into that? If so, how do you get started? Well, this can vary a little bit. There certainly are, you may find some of your local suppliers or manufacturers, if you have them, will private label for you. So I can certainly think of a niche that I'm involved in where there is a brand in that space that will private label for us their products, and we can do that. And they're locally based. Now that doesn't always happen. Sometimes you're going to have to go back to the source. So you're going to have to find out where your products are manufactured, where your brands getting their products manufactured. This is not actually that hard. Generally, a lot of products are manufactured in China. There's factories in China that make the same products for multiple brands, and you can find those, right? You got to do a bit of searching around, but you can find that if you want to. And it's as simple as reaching out to those companies in whatever country the manufacturing is happening in, and asking them, like, I want to do this. This is what I want to do. I want to put my brand on these type of products. What's that going to look like? What options do you have? You want to be aware of minimum MOQs, so minimum order quantities, and you want to try to negotiate around those. Obviously, in your interest, getting as low an MOQ as possible is in your interest. So if you can get a smaller number as possible, that's what you want to aim for in the beginning. It's often, sorry, I just saw Mark's question come in. I'll come to that, Mark. Thank you. It's often, not a bad idea if you can to go and visit the place where your product, where the product that you want to private label is made, meet the people face to face, go and see how it all happens. I think that's a good idea. And once again, that may require travel overseas for you to do that, which is fun. If your business has got traction, you should be generating rewards points, taking flights and things like that. You should be doing that on your business points and things like that. That's something you can do. So, it's private labeling is not something you need to overthink, really. I mean, if you're doing it, if you're simply putting your brand on existing products, then you should have some data to suggest that the products are selling. As long as you can get a low MOQ, if it's private labeling an existing product, then the product is already in the market with somebody else's brand on it, then, it's going to, be a reasonably safe bet, right? Now, the one little kicker that I would throw in here around private labeling is that if you're private labeling a product straight up and you're not changing the product, as in it's basically the same product as somebody else's product, but it's just private labeled, then you have to be aware that you're not going to sell that to branded traffic. Right. So you have to think about your marketing strategy a little bit. Once you stick your brand on a product, nobody's looking for that already. Right. They're looking for other people's products that are similar. But as soon as you put your brand on it, like you don't have, if you've been selling those products with existing search volume for existing brands, that's not going to automatically translate to your product just because you want it to. Right. So you have to take some of that. So you have to have a bit of a marketing plan, like how are you going to put your brand out there? What's going to happen on your website? How are you actually going to sell the products? Because you're not going to have any search traffic. Obviously, you'll have non-branded search traffic out there that relates to that product category. But you know, you have to have some plan around how you're actually going to sell that product. Like you're probably going to have to do things on your site, to in your customer service, in your sales pipeline, in your sales process, when customers call you, to refocus them to the ones, to the products with your brand on it, right? Because like I say, nobody's out there looking for it. And so that can change the dynamic a little bit. If you're sitting there saying, well, I'm selling this product from this brand and it's selling really well, so I think I could go and private label it, but you haven't taken into account that it's selling really well for branded product, like model name type of traffic, if you're running primarily paid traffic, those sales are not necessarily going to translate straight to you and whatever product you bring into the market. So I think, you know, you have to take that into account as well. But like, don't overthink it. I mean, if it's something you think you want to do, just like go and do it. Identify the product, work out your storage, find the manufacturer, go and meet them if you can. Make sure you, you know, have some faith in their process, in their shipping and all of that sort of thing. Get a low minimum order quantity and place the order. Get at it. That's the way to do it. Thanks for the question, Cassie. All right. Next question. I'm going to run along here for a couple more pre-submitted. Jackson asked a question. Hello, Jackson. I don't know if you're watching live, but thank you for asking your question. For somebody who has some knowledge from your podcast and small experience in dropshipping, what would you say to convince them if they are on the fence of joining, and I'm assuming that's joining Dropship Breakthrough, our course, due to the price, and worried they won't find success turning over a profitable business? Well, I think there's a lot of things I could say here, Jackson, and sometimes it can be good for other people other than me to say this, because I'm a bit self-interested because it's my course. But look, I would say a couple of things. I mean, if you're on the fence of joining due to the price, you're listening to the podcast, you might have already started having a go at it. Here's what I'll say. I would say that I would flip the question a little bit and say I would be more worried about not joining and the price that you're going to pay by not joining the course. So two things here. One, if you're interested in dropshipping and you're listening to our podcast, it's because you want to do something different in your life, right? You want to give dropshipping a go. You want to build a business. You want to generate more income. You want to free up your time. You want to be more in control of your life, whatever it might be. It's a little bit different for everybody, but those are usually the common kind of themes that we see for people who are here, right? So firstly, if you do nothing, nothing's going to change, right? So if you don't take a little leap, and to be honest, the price of the course, I mean, I'm not going to say it's cheap, but it's also not in the grand scheme of things expensive either. If you don't take a little bit of a leap, nothing changes. And yes, there is a little bit of risk involved. With any big, meaningful thing that can change your life or the trajectory of your life, there is going to be an element of risk. You cannot do anything good without risk. That's just the reality of existence. So you can choose to do nothing or you can choose to take action. If you choose to do nothing, then nothing in your life will change forever. I actually sent an email about this morning, so you might have got it in your inbox if you're on our email list. Like literally nothing changes if you don't take action. So, I mean, that's the first thing to say, right? So to me, the price of not taking action in life is far more significant than $1,000 here or $1,000 there or something like that. Like the thought of not never taking action and never pushing myself forward and changing things is fucking terrifying to me. And I don't know how it's not terrifying for everybody else. I know life for a lot of people is comfortable and blah, blah, blah. But like if you're listening to our shit, it can't be that comfortable, because otherwise you wouldn't be listening to what, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be paying attention to anything that we say. So ask yourself that, you know, looking at your image, you don't look like you're terribly old. Like what's the next 40 years look like for you if you do nothing? Are you happy with that? Or are you happy with taking a small risk that you can change that dynamic? So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is, as you say in your question, you've been listening to the podcast, you've got some small experience in dropshipping. Let me be completely frank here. A lot of people start businesses, high-ticket dropshipping businesses, listening to our podcast, right? Which is fantastic. Some of those people make sales and they start making some progress. That's fantastic. I mean, it's just a podcast. To be honest, when me and Ben started that, we had no idea that was going to happen. We didn't actually think people would like start businesses just listening to the podcast and doing nothing else. And yet it happens. It still happens. That's fantastic. And that's a huge thing to be able to help people in that way with a podcast that we record, you know, once a week or once a fortnight, and it's free, right? That's really cool. But let's be real. The people who make the most, who get the most success here are not the people who listen, who just listen to the podcast. Like at our live event last month, we gave out a bunch of awards, people who have hit $1 million in their business in revenue. We even gave out our first $10 million awards, people who have hit $10 million in revenue in their business. Like there's nobody who just listened to the podcast and started a business and didn't take any small risks financially who are doing millions of dollars in revenue. The people who are doing millions of dollars of revenue in our community are in our program. And that's because there's a lot more in the program. There's a lot in the program we can't put on a podcast. Like it's just the format's wrong. It's too deep. Like when you see how deep our course is, you'd probably understand that. And so the cost of not joining the course but trying to do it is much higher because you're going to make mistakes. You're going to lose money. You're going to run bad ads, right? Generally speaking. I mean, you know, that's just what happens. And so, you know, the point of a course is actually to save you money. Yes, you have to put a little bit of money in the beginning, but it's you're getting the advantage of a decade of my experience, a decade of Ben's experience combined, and all the mistakes that we've made that we help you to avoid. And let me tell you right now, I've lost tens of thousands, if not over $100,000 in like failed marketing experiments and things like that in my time, right? I've lost that, but I learned things from losing that, right? And those things are in the course. And yeah, some of those things make their way onto the podcast as well, of course, but primarily they're in the course, not to mention the support and part of being a community and the way that supports you through your journey and increases the chance that you're going to be successful. So my response to that really is you can't afford to not join the course if you want to make any change in your life in the realms of high-ticket dropshipping. Obviously, there's other ways and other businesses you could go and start, and if you want to do that, more power to you. But you've got to give it a crack. So you can see it going along the bottom of the screen, dropshipbreakthrough.com/join. Get in there. Take a little chance, you know, at the end of the day. If you're committed, you take action consistently, you're going to make the cost of entry to the course back. Like the only reason that people don't do that is because they quit. And some people say, well, of course you would say that, blah, blah, blah. No, I really say that. The only people who don't get a return on the course are the people who quit. So easy choice for you there. Don't quit. You've got no risk. And if you do, even if you're not satisfied there, we have a guarantee on the course that if you run a business for 12 months and you don't do $100,000 in sales, we'll give you your money back. So literally it's risk-free. Either you're going to make $100,000 in sales or you're going to get your money back. All you've got to do is take action though, right? So we don't reward people who don't take action, but if you're somebody who can take action, you're going to get a reward. So thanks for that question, Jackson. All right, I'm going to jump over and do a live question here. Let's see. Mark, your question made me laugh, so I'm going to go to that one first. Mark says, give us a peek into your daily routine. Wake up at noon, video conference with various staff, afternoon siesta, finish up with a cigar and a drink on the beach. Lol. Just wondering what the dream life looks like. I found this question very funny. And thank you for asking it, Mark. Look, it is absolutely none of those things. The dream life, look, my life, and I will comment a little bit on this. My life is what I want my life to be. Like, you know, the great thing about finding success with business, and particularly in the types of businesses that we run here, is that you do have more options to design the life that you want to have around your business. So John's version of this is just John's version of this. This is not to say that it could be different if I wanted it to be different, but it is what it is right now because that's what it is and that's what it needs to be. So I preface everything I say that I have four children who are all pretty much school-aged, and so my life is kind of based around them in a lot of ways. We do a lot of different things with them, and that takes up a lot of my time. But generally speaking, you know, I get up when my kids get up, which is still pretty early in the morning. I don't have, at this point in time, some insane morning routine. I think morning routines are, I mean, look, if they work for you, fantastic, but in entrepreneurial circles, they're a load of bullshit, right? The notion that you need to have some morning routine where you journal for 20 minutes, where you get in a sauna, where you get in an ice bath, where you do some upside down weird exercises, where you do this before you even do fucking anything useful is nonsense. You don't need that. But if you do have some version of that and it works for you and you can demonstrate that it makes you more productive or, you know, helps you to focus or whatever it is, then fucking fantastic. That's great. But I don't have that. I get up in the morning. I do stuff with my kids. I feed them. I don't know when I get up, like between 5 and 6 a.m. I do all of that stuff. Depending what day of the week it is, I come into my office here somewhere between either 5 a.m. or 9 a.m. Take your pick. It varies a lot. I deal a lot with people in the US, of course, including my business partner, Ben, at Dropship Breakthrough. We record podcasts at 6 a.m. my time in the morning some days. Depending on what day of the week it is, who I have to talk to, being in Australia and time zones, I usually start pretty early. But then there's some days I start late where I take the kids to school and do all that sort of thing. So I come into the office and I do whatever needs doing. Every day for me is wildly different based on some days I'm working with our business partners. Some days me and Ben are recording podcasts or we're having our Dropship Breakthrough business meetings. Some days I'm doing coaching. Some days I'm, you know, just hands-on doing things in various businesses, whether it's Dropship Breakthrough or e-commerce businesses or whatever. I think my days do vary a lot, which keeps it interesting. And then once again, some days I'm here until 1:30 in the afternoon. Some days I'm here until 4:30 in the afternoon or 5 p.m. or something. It just depends on what's happening, right? So I do that, you know, eat some food in the middle there, drink some coffee. It's all pretty healthy, you know, it's all pretty boring. And then, you know, I go do stuff with my kids in the afternoon, whatever that might be. Going to the beach, taking them to gymnastics. They all do gymnastics, taking them to whatever it might be, all sorts of different things. I go home, have dinner, put the kids to bed. And then I go to the gym after that. So I get down. I work out in the evening at the moment. And I'm pretty consistent with that. Hit the gym, or sometimes I run or I'll do some cardio or something like that. But generally speaking, I'm lifting in the gym for an hour or so from about 8 p.m. till about 9 p.m. or something like that. And then usually I'll go home and there's a gym near where I live. That's where I go. It's very close to my house. And then I'll go home and, you know, do whatever. Oftentimes I do a bit more work at that point. You know, like I'll be honest, like I'm a bit of a freak when it comes to doing the work. Like this is my hobby and my business and my income. Like I don't have I just love it so much and it's the best game that you can possibly play that I don't really do a lot of other things. Like I watch sports and I watch, you know, rugby league here in Australia. I'm a bit of a tragic for my local team, the Penrith Panthers, where I grew up. But like, I don't have a lot of outside of doing things with my kids and whatnot. I don't like do woodworking where I file away for hours in a workshop or some shit like that. If I'm going to do something, I'm going to go and make some money. That's the fun thing for me. Then I go to sleep, get about 7 hours of sleep a night, something like that. So And yeah, I do go to the beach a lot. Usually it's with the kids though. I do live near the beach. Everybody knows that. So there's a lot of other things in there, but that's broadly speaking what it looks like. And that's the way it needs to be for me at the moment. You know, next year we'll do our family's going to do a lot of probably overseas travel. And so next year, my days are going to look very different while I'm still working and running businesses. So for me, it does vary a bit, but it's pretty boring, to be honest. I don't drink, I don't smoke or anything like that. That's how I get the best out of myself. So I hope that answers your question, Mark. All right, next question. Comes from, just trying to find a question here that I can actually answer. I can't get a name on this one. It comes up as SER from YouTube. Hello, SER on YouTube. My site is well established and get yeses from probably 90% of brands, so suppliers. We're in a broad niche, outdoor furniture, but ads are holding me back. Running waterfall 3-tier campaign around 50,000 per month. I assume that's in sales, but not sure if that's the best. Well, the first thing I will say is to that SER is that it's very unlikely that it's ads that are holding you back. Now, ads get a lot of attention in the dropshipping space. Everybody talks about ads and running ads and doing all this sort of thing. And I'm assuming SER that you're doing high ticket dropshipping outdoor furniture. It's probably fairly mostly high ticket dropshipping. Now, ads don't hold you back like as such, right? Like it's search traffic. You're probably mostly running search engine based marketing. So there is whatever search volume there is, and you can access that if you want to. Usually it's more a question of your profitability holds you back, or your conversion rates holding you back, or you know, your sales and customer service process is holding you back. Ads are like the easiest part of this pie, right? I mean, turn on ads, get traffic, pay more, get more traffic. I mean, that's all ads are. The 3-tier campaign thing, assuming your products are high ticket. I don't call it waterfall. I don't know who calls it that. One of the ripoff people probably calls it that. That's for high ticket products. That's still the best. There is a lot of nuance to how you do the 3-tier campaign thing. There are different ways of doing it. There are more advanced ways of doing it, and there are less advanced ways of doing it for sure. But generally speaking, that model is still the best for high ticket products. Things like performance max ads and all that sort of stuff do not work for high ticket products at this point. There is no evidence whatsoever out there to suggest that they do. And so that's the best. But I would bring you back to like there's a lot more to this piece than ads. And so when I look at businesses, I've looked at thousands of businesses in this space over the last 8 or 9 years of other people's, and everybody always wants to talk about ads, but when you really look, that's not really where it's at. It's a bit hard for me to answer questions specifically about that, but as to whether you're got the right approach to ads, yes, that's the approach that works. If you're struggling to get it to work, or to be in a place where you can confidently spend more on ads, then that's a different set of questions. And that can come from a whole different, you can come at that from a lot of different angles. And it's not about knowing how to run the ads. Like I say, that's a reasonably straightforward part. There are much more difficult things to work out. All right, next question. I'm going to go back to pre-submitted questions. Joshua asks a question. Hi, John, long time listening. Finally bit the bullet and bought the course. Nice one, Joshua. Good on you. And I'm having a great time in building. A couple of the suppliers I've landed do not advertise their prices on their website, and they have a call for a quote type approach. I've spoken with both these suppliers, and they have both stated this is for the competitive nature of their product, being both small businesses. I'm not sure how to move forward with these supplies, as if I'm correct, I can't use Google Shopping with no price. Thanks for the question, Joshua, and thanks for joining the program, of course. That's fantastic. Yes, well, you're correct. If you don't have a price on a product on your website, you can't run Google Shopping ads to it. Now, that's not to say you couldn't send any traffic to it, from like paid traffic, but yes, Google Shopping is not going to be an option. Now, it's not unusual to have products where there's not like a fixed price. There's a lot of products out there. And in fact, I work with some products where they're kind of made to order based on there just being a lot of different size variation or feature variation, and individual customers having kind of individualized use cases. So, you know, it's not unusual in the high ticket space to find products like that. And those products that I'm referring to, they could be anywhere between sort of, you know, $10,000 and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so, you know, you can't run Google Shopping is not the greatest traffic source for those, but that doesn't mean there isn't. So for those, you can certainly still use search text ads, to send people to that page and capture leads. So send people to a page about the product, where they then can, you know, fill out a little form, request a quote type deal, or, you know, you can push them to a phone call. And so you still can make sales definitely with those type of products. You know, it's probably going to be a difficult thing to, I mean, I think from what I understand of what your suppliers are saying, it's a fairly irrational fear on their part, about them not wanting to reveal their pricing because competitors might find out or something. Like, I mean, that's kind of nonsense. Like, at the end of the day, if you were a competitor and you wanted to find out how much their prices are, you would just go and request a quote from them and pretend to be a customer. Like, it's pretty easy. So for them, they're sitting there, they're holding an irrational fear about their market. It's going to be difficult for you to change an irrational fear. Like, the whole of humanity at the moment is beset by a series of irrational fears, and like, nothing changes. So these can be difficult things to deal with. You know, if it was because, you know, if it was in the case of their products were like really customizable and they didn't want to set prices because they weren't able to have a price available at every point in time to cover all of the customizations, that's a little bit easier to deal with. What I would say to them in that circumstance is, can you just give me a price for the base version of this product, and we'll deal with any customizations on an as needs basis, like as on a request basis. Because what the, and I've done this, what that allows you to do is at least advertise the base model. And when people come to that page, say, hey, we can also do these various crazy things with this product, but you need to call us, or we need to have a chat to you to work that out. But it still allows you to use Google Shopping ads to get people to that product page. So I don't know if that's some sort of an angle you can take with them around, around that, like, just say, look, is there a circumstance where we can just get like a base rate for your product or something like that? You know, but if they don't want to do that, like, once again, I mean, don't freak out. You can still use those brands and those products. You can just run search text ads to those web pages. You can still target their brand names or their model names or whatever it might be, and you just send people in with search text ads. Of course, over time, you're going to generate organic traffic, which you can funnel towards those products as well. And so at the end of the day, I know we put a lot of emphasis on Google Shopping in the beginning, but by no means is it the be-all and end-all of traffic generation. It's nice, it's good, it's cool, but like, I think we can get overly focused on it sometimes and its importance. So don't sweat it. You're going to get other suppliers and other brands. So, like I say, you know, it's probably going to be hard to change their mind right now on that. You might over time, you know, build a relationship with them, work with them a bit more, you know, try and move them through whatever it is they're afraid of. But it's probably going to be difficult to do that in the beginning. So take them on board, still put their products on and all that sort of thing, and you'll find a way to use them. So thanks for the question, Joshua. Next one down the list, Richard asks, is it still all right to use a UPS address for your business, or is there more of a chance of getting a Google merchant suspension now if you use a UPS address, or I suppose a virtual address? I'll paraphrase into that question as well. This is a difficult one. It's hard to definitively say either way what the story is here. It's certainly is possible that Google doesn't like some virtual addresses or UPS addresses. Like there are some places that give out addresses that are very well known to be virtual because they literally have, you know, so many thousands of addresses listed at the same actual physical location, which is unrealistic. So I can imagine a scenario where some places that list virtual addresses are known to organizations like Google, and they have a problem with that. They don't actually actively say that anywhere, however. I will note that. And so I see people who are running ads right now, including me, who do not have an actual physical business address on their website or associated with their business, and I'm running ads and it's working fine. Like there's plenty of those people. There are also plenty of people who use an actual physical address, like their home address or some other sort of physical address, and that's working fine for them. And there are some people who have had a suspension, and at some point during the process of trying to get that unsuspended, they changed their address, and that may have been a factor in that. Now, no one told them definitively that it was, but they did that change, and then their account got unsuspended. So it's really hard to say. I mean, it's, you know, like I say, Google publishes nothing about this. So everybody that says, like, it's this way, you can't have a virtual address, those people are guessing. They don't know that. Nobody at Google knows that, right? So how does anybody else know it? If it were me, honestly, today, I just use like my home address for everything. Like I put my home address on businesses. I mean, I have a business address here as well. Like I'm sitting in a business address and I can put that address on things too, but I don't see why you need to, years going back, I had a different answer for sure. And I probably had a different answer on our podcast in some of the older episodes. But at this point in time, I've used my home address on businesses for a decade, and that's never been a problem. Not even once has it been a problem for me. And so I just don't know why you wouldn't do that. Like what are you afraid is going to happen? Like customers are suddenly going to turn up at your door in droves, and that doesn't happen. Yeah, unless you've got some really good reason, like maybe you're in another country or something like that. Like if you're based in another country and your business is based in one country, you're physically located in another, then you probably wouldn't put your home address on, and you might need to use something like a UPS address, right? Try it, give it a go. But if you don't have any real reason other than something that's in your head that you think is going to happen, then that's probably not a good reason to use a virtual. So just use your own address. Like, get over it. Be proud of your business. Like, it's your business. Why can't it be based where you live? Anyway, hope that answered your question, Richard. All right, I'll come back to some live questions here for you guys who are hanging out. Oh, Harry actually asked exactly the same question. Do you think it's okay to use your home address for your business address for the first year? Yes. I just answered that, Harry. So I hope that helps. Not just for the first year, for every year. It's fine. It's fine. There are many, many, many small businesses in the world, in the US, in Australia, in the UK, everywhere, that are run from people's private residences. Like probably literally millions. There is no reason that yours can't be any different. Okay? Like you think of it, like, you know, contractor businesses, electricians, plumbers, builders, like these guys all run their businesses from their from where they live. So, I mean, you're no different, right? Just because you're doing e-commerce or dropshipping or something doesn't make you any different. So next question. So Nsound asks, Nsound from YouTube. I love the YouTube names. They're always, they're like your channel name, I guess. It's never anybody's real name. But anyway, Nsound, thanks for being here. My site is set up, ads are running. I'm paying about $100 a day and have only got one sale in the past 3 weeks when I launched ads. I'm meticulous about my negative keywords and keep my ad tiers good. And then there's a couple of ones down here. I also have plenty of top brands live, so I don't think that is the problem. Cool. It feels like I'm just wasting over $100 a day in my ads. So this question, and I've answered this a lot on the Dropship podcast. So, you know, you'll probably find a lot of episodes there where we deal with this sort of thing. I bring you back to the purpose of ads. The purpose of ads is to send the right traffic to your website for the right price at the right time. That's it. Ads don't, in and of themselves, create conversions. It's just about putting somebody on your website. Now, there's still a long way from that to that person buying, particularly if you're doing high ticket products. I mean, if you're not doing high ticket products, I don't want to talk to you. Like, I'm not interested in that. So I'm assuming you're doing high ticket products, right? And so there's a lot that happens there. The customer journey is long. It's often long. It's often measured in months for high ticket products. Sometimes it's immediate, but oftentimes it's not. So, but there's a lot that can happen there. You know, people are comparison shopping. So it's not just a case of getting your ads right and the sales automatically flow. There's a lot of other factors. There's your customer service. There's your offer. There's the competitive nature of your market. And are you fully on top of that? Yes, having the right suppliers on your site is a, can be a part of it too. I mean, you've said that you think you've got plenty of top brands, so that might be a box that you've ticked for sure. But there are a range of other factors. Ads are just about getting the traffic to your site. Your site is about producing the conversion. Your site, your customer service, your sales process, all of these things combine your offer, how competitive you are in the market on your offer. All of these things combine to help that sale happen, help that person feel comfortable about making that sale. So firstly, I'd probably say you don't need to spend $100 a day. I mean, I'd start with $30 a day. Like, until you make more sales, I'd probably dial it back a little bit. If you've been live for 3 weeks and you've only made one sale, you shouldn't be at $100 a day. That's not where we suggest people start. Now, you might want to go faster and all of that sort of thing, and that's admirable. And it's great that you're, keeping your negative keywords and all of that sort of stuff locked down. That's fantastic. That definitely things you need to do. So you're on the right track there. But I would say that the danger with pushing harder in the beginning is that you haven't got the piece after the traffic locked down yet, probably. And so, yes, it's possible that you're sending a lot of traffic to your site and not seeing a return because there's probably some other holes that you haven't plugged yet in the customer journey, in that person's path to a conversion happening. If you're spending $100 a day, you better be retargeting and doing all that stuff sort of thing as well. Right. So once again, this is really the kind of thing where you need to sit down with somebody and actually look at what they're doing, look at their site, look at all of the factors combine here that influence whether or not the sale occurs, for me to say what's going on there. But like to answer your question, it's not just ads. There's a lot more to the piece than just ads. So I hope in some way that helps. You end sound. All right, moving along. Emma, staying up late. Emma, if I had seen your question earlier, I would have answered it earlier because I know how late it is for you there. Would you say if you relied on Google Ads only, you would never guarantee being consistently successful? Therefore, would you say it is the traction gained by SEO that really guarantees you consistent sales / profitable business? Now, that's an interesting question, Emma. And I like that you phrase it, would you say? I would say in my answer that relying on Google Ads only won't guarantee consistent success across all niches. That's what I would say. There are some niches where it's possible to have consistent success just with ads, yes, but there are some where it's not. And so the effect of paid traffic is very inconsistent across niches. So if you happen to be in a niche where you can get a level of success, and I mean consistently successful, like what does that mean? I mean, that's a subjective mark, right? So what I consider to be success is probably different from what somebody else considers. But let's basically say like success is you're profitable, you know, you're doing a decent amount of revenue and you're doing an amount of profit that you could live off, let's say, without having to have a job or something like that, right? So let's say that's success. Yes, you can definitely do that just with ads. In fact, there are people in our membership who do that just with ads primarily and almost no SEO. But that won't work for everybody. So that's what I would say about the consistency with ads. However, when you combine ads with SEO and you make gains on SEO and that starts producing for your business, then yes, that is always going to be consistent across all niches as something that will develop a successful business. That's what I would say about those two things combined. Ads are great, but they work better in some niches than others, for sure. SEO is fantastic and in the medium to longer term is the best traffic source for high-ticket dropshipping businesses. Probably for a lot of other businesses as well, for that matter. And when you combine the two, it's even better. So if you can combine the two, like whatever outcomes you can get from paid traffic and you combine that with SEO, then that's where, you know, the real magic happens. But look, there are niches out there. And no, I can't tell you what they are. And no, you can't predict what they're going to be. Because these are the follow-up questions everybody asks. All right, can you tell me the niches where ads work really well? Because I don't want to do the SEO work. No, I can't tell you that. But there are niches out there where ads, you know, I know people who do, you know, $3-4 million a year in revenue just off Google shopping ads and have did that for years, right? So yeah, I mean, it's possible, but probably not the norm. Thank you, though, Emma, for that question. All right, continuing down the live ones. Big Bucks No Whammies, YouTube, yes, asks, thoughts on PMAX for high ticket? Crap is my thought on that. Yeah, look, doesn't work. Doesn't work at this point. Doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Well, And I would say my answer would be different if we were talking about low ticket. I think I have certainly seen examples, including ones in accounts that I've actually managed myself back when I used to manage a lot of Google Ads accounts, which is not something I do right now, where Performance Max did better than manually managed campaigns of some sort. But for a high ticket, I've never seen that. I've never seen anybody, and I've tested it, yes. And I've never seen anybody produce any evidence, anybody else anywhere produce any evidence that PMAX works well for high ticket products. I'd love to see it. I'm not against Performance Max. Let's be honest. I mean, if it worked well, great. When it works well and it works well consistently, we'll absolutely recommend people use it. Don't get me wrong. But it doesn't. Now, why doesn't it? Well, the primary reason why I think it doesn't, and in fact, why other automated bidding strategies, because Performance Max is an automated – an automated bid, you know, automated campaign system. And so there are other automated bidding strategies which also don't work very well. The reason is, like, for most people, and at scale this might be a little bit different, right? But all of these automated things, they rely on conversion data to optimize. I mean, it's the same with Facebook ads or any other pay-per-click ads, right? They need a volume of data to optimize and find the right customer, right? So you rarely in the beginning are, like, for a low ticket product, you have a lot of sales volume, like individual order volume. Like, you're selling $30 products. You might sell, you know, 100 of those in a day and you've got the sales thing needed, but you just, that's only $3,000 in revenue. Like, so what, right? Like, whereas I can generate $10,000 in revenue off one sale. Now, it's a lot of revenue, but it's only one sale, and it's volume of conversions required to optimize. It's not revenue, right? And so that's the problem, is that are you going to generate 50 sales a week with a high ticket product, right? Are you going to generate that sort of volume? Now, you can at some point with a high ticket dropshipping business, but in the beginning, are you going to? No, you're not. And so that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that for me is that for a lot of high ticket dropshipping niches, the customer journey is long. Like, it might be measured in months, and Performance Max can't take that into account. Like, Performance Max takes over other parts of your ads as well. It makes it a bit more challenging to run good remarketing stuff, right? Like we have very specific remarketing systems that we use for these businesses as well, which Performance Max can't match those. Like, it doesn't produce its own content. And it doesn't produce the right content. And I see your comments, Jeff, and I appreciate that. Who is this guy? Like, I want to meet this guy. Whenever I talk about this, there's always somebody that says, I know one guy who does this and blah, blah, blah. But who is the guy? Where is the guy? Can you introduce me to the guy? I want to see his ad accounts. Like, this is the thing. Like, proof isn't proof until you see it on a screen in a way that can work for 1,000 people. Like, not one guy. I'm not going to talk about this shit. Like, I've got thousands of people who rely on me for, like, ad advice, right? So one guy is not a statistically viable set of data. It's just not. But I want to see it. Like, I believe you. I hope that guy's out there. I want to see it, but I want to have a chat with him. Okay, you don't like the guy, you just know of him. Have you seen inside his ad accounts? Because I'll tell you right now, there are a pack of dickheads out there who proclaim that this stuff works, but they don't actually do it. And they don't actually show any evidence that they do it. So unless I see inside some motherfucker's actual ad account that's doing this stuff, it's bullshit. I'm calling it as bullshit. So produce evidence. Like, send this video on to the guy. I'm calling him out as bullshit until I see it. It's bullshit. Like, I've done it. I've tested it. I can run ads perfectly profitably, and I've done it to the tune of over $100 million in revenue, and I've tested Performance Max, and it doesn't beat my managed campaigns. So, like I say, I want to see the evidence on this one, because I don't believe it. Cool. All right. So, next question, getting down the list here. Dion asks, hi, John. Typically, what would you say are the top three things high ticket dropshipping businesses often neglect/need to focus on in their first few months of going live to the public? Good question, Dion. Well, certainly, you know, we've mentioned some of these things, but obviously, if you're going live with paid traffic, sorry. Yeah, good one, Jeff. That automatically just proves it's bullshit. Like, what a toss. Anyway, don't want to reveal his niche. There's no secret niches. He's not sitting on some private gold mine that nobody else knows about. What a load of toss. Anyway, Yeah. So if you're running paid traffic, obviously, you need to be paying attention to your paid traffic. You need to get practiced at managing your ads and, you know, working out all of that sort of stuff, right? So, you know, get good practices in there. Make sure you've got your keyword targeting reasonably on point. You know, it takes a little bit of cleaning up in the beginning to get it there. You'll get it there though. So that's certainly one thing to focus on. But I think you really need to focus on what brands you have on your store. So I think this is a big one. I say this a lot. Some brands sell better than others on high ticket dropshipping businesses. Sometimes, you know, you go and you do your first round of supplier calls and, you know, let's say you've got a list of 30 that you want to reach out to. You make a few calls, you get some yeses, you get some nos. There's probably some you didn't hear back from. There's probably some you didn't get around to. Let's say you get four or five on, you go live, which is fine. You should. You shouldn't stop there though. So a lot of people will stop there and then not go and try and get more brands. You should then go back to the list and keep hitting them up, because you might not have got the five good ones out of that list of 30. You might not know which are the good ones. In fact, you probably won't. Oftentimes it can be a bit of a dark horse that turns out to be a really great seller for you. And so you've really got to keep pushing on that list and getting those suppliers on board. I think it's not a sexy thing, but it's a big priority for a high ticket dropshipping business. So that's one thing I would say. And then the next thing I would say is I would really focus on your customer, like getting to know your customer, talking to your customer, and finding any way you can to get people on the phone. Like for high ticket products, you're just going to sell a lot more when you talk to people. Particularly if you're in a B2B niche or you have particularly high ticket products, and you're also going to learn about your customer, what they want, what they're seeing in your market, right? You know, like you're a reseller, so competition is an important consideration. But really, what are your customers seeing? Like you do your competitive research and you find all the competitors, and that's great. That's a great exercise to go through. But at the end of the day, your customer isn't looking at all of those competitors. They're probably only looking at two or three at most, right? Seriously. And so who are those? Now, you will have your own assumptions about who those might be, but oftentimes they're your assumptions because now you look at everything differently to the way a customer does. You're now looking at everything with your business, you know, mind, right? And so your view is a little bit different now. You're forever kind of influenced by that. And so talking to your customers is a very important thing. So finding ways that you can encourage customers to get on the phone with your business, like building things into your site to do this, I think is a big priority. And then when you do talk to customers, like intentionally asking them questions to learn more about your market, your niche, why people are not buying from you, who people are considering buying from, why that's the case, and then taking action on that feedback, right? Maybe you hear from three people that, I saw this thing on this other website and I didn't see it on yours. Okay, go and put that thing on your website, right? So I think that's what I would say. Those are the three things. Like in the beginning, in the first few months, get good at get your traffic right, get more brands, get more products on your site, get more into your ads, and then talk to as many customers as you can. Get feedback from as many customers as you can and take action on that to build a better offer on your website, to improve the performance of your product pages, right? Because at the end of the day, it's what you think is kind of not relevant. What your customers think is kind of everything. And so let that guide you in that space. All right, continuing along here, Citrone asks a couple of questions. First one, are you able to give me a few markets that are too competitive? Yeah, sure, I can give you a few markets that are too competitive. E-bikes, e-anything, e-skateboards, e-scooters, too competitive. Infrared saunas, too competitive. Lights, chandeliers, things like that, too competitive. In fact, most homewares, too competitive. That's a lot of products, right, in the homeware space. generally speaking, too competitive. It's why we don't talk about it. Like, you know, lounges, tables, dining tables, all of that sort of stuff. Too competitive. Like, I wouldn't even bother with that sort of stuff, generally speaking. I mean, that's all in the US too. I mean, if you're in a smaller country somewhere in the world, those answers may not be the same. For Australia, I would say those answers are exactly the same still. For the UK, possibly. Yeah, there's a few there that I would definitely say are too competitive. Jeff, I do see your first question. I haven't forgotten you there. At what point should I begin running email marketing? Yeah, it's a good question. I would probably certainly be thinking about it. I mean, time is going to be a bit of a factor here, and like how involved you need to be in it to get it happening. Is it something you're going to outsource part of? Like, are you going to get somebody to help you write the emails, or are you going to write the emails yourself? Either or is a good answer. I mean, it's not a case of one or the other, but obviously one is going to require more of your time than the other. So you have to factor in your time and the range of things that you've got going on. I think certainly in the beginning, you want to have a few bits of email marketing locked down. Like obviously pretty early on, you should have a really good abandoned checkout, email flow set up of sort of 5 to 10 emails. You should have that set up very early on because you're going to get abandoned checkouts early on, right? You know, a little sequence of emails to welcome a new customer when they first purchase from you is probably a good thing to have early on, because, you know, repeat business is a good thing. You want to leave a good impression on new customers, right? But then past that, I mean, there's a ton of other email marketing to do, and there's obviously, you know, sort of regular email blasts. There's a whole bunch of other automated sequences that you could build out. So when do you do that? I think I would certainly focus on getting the work done. Obviously, like if I just launched, like, at what point you want to be have a pretty good bit going on your paid traffic, have that pretty well locked down. You want to have done at least a significant amount of work with suppliers and getting products onto your website and well optimized products onto your website. And then I think you want to have started a lot of the SEO piece, right? You want to have that happening. Like, and so we break the SEO piece down into, you know, product page SEO, collection page SEO, technical SEO. Right. Those are probably the three main areas where I would want to have a good plan and a good set of practices occurring. You don't need to have had to have done all of that work because there's quite a bit of work there. But I would want my focus to be on that, because the earlier you get that stuff happening, the better. And it's going to give you more opportunities to take advantage of strategies like email marketing and retargeting. I mean, those two things work best off top to middle of the funnel traffic, which generally is going to come organically in large volumes for a high ticket dropshipping business. You're not going to run paid traffic to hot top of funnel search terms in great volumes for a high ticket dropshipping business. Usually there are some exceptions, but usually you're not. And so I think from a nurture perspective, like email marketing, which is about taking a customer through a journey to the point of purchase and that sort of thing, you're going to get a greater impact from that at the top of the funnel, rather than if you're generating a lot of bottom of funnel type search traffic from paid ads in the beginning. Email marketing doesn't really add a lot to that. Like from the case of abandoned checkouts and things, yes, it does, but otherwise it doesn't really, because the customer's almost there anyway. Like, where are you're not really taking them that far. So I think that's what I would say. When you get to that point, whenever that is, I mean, it might be 3 months in for some people. It might be 6 months in. It might be 12 months in for some people. But that's certainly, I would have my focus on those other areas before I get to email marketing. Once you start ranking pages organically though, whether they're collection pages or content pages, you then have a really good opportunity to start capturing emails on your website. And this is probably the kicker. If you're capturing emails, then you should be doing email marketing, right? That's what I would say. The minute you start capturing emails, you should be doing something, because there's no point adding people to an email list and never emailing them. Because if you start emailing them three to six months later, they're not going to remember who you are, and you're more likely to start getting hit with spam and going in the spam folder and affecting your deliverability at that point. If you've got a list of people that's completely cold that you've never emailed, and then you start emailing them, so kind of you have to think about that a little bit. So whenever you start capturing emails, like, I would hold off from aside from new customers and things like that. I mean, yes, you're going to capture them, but like from cold people who haven't bought from you yet, if you're going to start capturing those emails, that's when you need to start email marketing. So hold off from trying to capture lots of emails until you're ready to start email marketing, is what I would say. So I'm going to answer a question about this in just a second. So I hope that helps, Jeff. Not to mention the other reason why I say that as well is, once you get into the SEO piece, you start producing content that gives you a lot more fodder for your email marketing as well, right? So, you know, you get into like producing content on your site, you can use all of that content in your email marketing strategy, and it makes it easy to fill out your email marketing strategy. Whereas if you're right at the beginning, like, what are you emailing people? Like, oh, here's a product, buy it. Oh, here's a product, buy it. Like, that's not a very good email marketing strategy in and of itself. So I'm going to flip over to my last sort of pre-submitted question here from Miguel. Hi, Miguel, and thank you for your question. When making quizzes for your collection page, something people will know that John is a massive fan of, and in fact, I did a talk on this at our last live event. Is there such a thing as too many questions? Is there a right and a wrong way to do it? There absolutely is, Miguel. And yes, there is such a thing as too many questions. So quizzes are a fantastic way to do what we were talking about in the previous question, which is collect email addresses while also helping your customer and solving a pretty big pain point that exists on high-ticket dropshipping websites, which is that they're high-ticket dropshipping, they're online websites. So what don't you have on an online website? You don't have a salesperson, as opposed to a physical retail store. Customer walks into a physical retail store, salesperson comes up and says, oh, ask you a bunch of questions about what you're looking for. And then as a result of the answers to those questions, they say, you need that product over there. That's all you need to think about. Don't worry about all these other products. That's the product for you. This is the value, like, for the customer journey of a salesperson. They cut the fluff if they're good, right? And a lot of salespeople are not good. But if they're good, that's what they do, right? They ask the questions that matter, that help a customer actually work out what outcome, hone in on what outcome they need, and then match a product that can actually provide that outcome to that customer, right? That's what a salesperson should do. And then, yeah, then they do all the sales stuff on the end of that and persuade the customer to buy the product. But like, that's part of what happens in physical retail stores that's really hard to replicate on an e-commerce store, unless the person gets on the phone and calls you, in which case you can do that. But most customers don't get on the phone and call you, right? So for high ticket products, oh, there's my little gestures thing happening. For high ticket products, the added problem is, and for a high ticket dropshipping store, is that you have a lot of products usually. And oftentimes you can have a lot of products that look very similar but are different, right? Like high ticket products, like in a lot of niches, they're pretty boring looking things. They all look kind of the same. It's really hard for the customer to tell what's the difference between any of these things. And then you go onto like somebody's collection page and they've got seven pages. They've got pagination seven deep of all the same types of products. Now, that's good from some perspectives for the business, but for the customer journey, if the customer's in the middle of the funnel, particularly, and they're kind of like, I need this type of product, but look at all these products, I'm confused. How are you getting people to the answer that they need in the shortest amount of time possible using your perceived authority that the customer has of you? Well, a quiz helps you do that. Content can help you do that as well, but once again, not everybody's going to consume your content either. So you need to have multiple avenues that you're helping people through that kind of middle of the funnel bit where they know what type of product they need, but they don't know which product is the product that will give them the specific outcome they're looking for. And that's what people are buying, is the outcome. So quizzes help massively with this. And they're also great for lead generation, which is, you know, getting email addresses, getting phone numbers that you can follow up people with email marketing, with outbound custom, with outbound sales approaches and things like that. But yes, for a quiz, you can have too many questions. Like, people's attention online is short. It's short, right? If you put a quiz in front of somebody that's 20 pages long, they're going to get bored halfway through, and you'll probably say, and you can test this though. So a quiz tool that I'm using at the moment on Shopify, and I'm just going to open a Shopify account here so that I can see it. I actually do this on our sites as well. I'll give you a couple of tools that you can use if you're interested in running a quiz on your site. I'm just opening an account here because I always forget the exact name of it. The first one is Shop Quiz, colon Product Recommender. That's the name. You can go on the Shopify App Store and look that up, Shop Quiz Product Recommender. Another one I can recommend is Quiz Kit, which also has a Shopify app, I believe. So Shop Quiz, you know, when you have a quiz set up in there, it gives you stats about how your quiz is performing, and you can see the drop-off rate, right? And so the part of the optimization around quizzes is looking at the metrics and the data that they produce, and primarily looking at the drop-off rate and seeing if you can identify where people are dropping off. Now, what I have seen in the past with quizzes is that the more questions you have, you tend to find people drop off part of the way through the quiz. Now, sometimes you can see a drop off on individual questions, and it's got to do with the question, how the question is worded, and you can actually change the question a bit and you'll find that drop off rate changes. But usually if you make it too long, people will drop off partway through. They'll just be like, oh, where is this going? I'm getting bored, blah, blah, blah. And they run out of time. They get distracted. Like, literally the average time on a site, I don't know what it is. It's really short these days, right? So you don't want to make somebody sit there for 5 minutes answering a quiz to get a product recommendation. So you've got to have a balance between kind of convenience and also giving people the result. Now, it's also important to recognize with a quiz, you're not looking to answer every single person out there. Right. And this can often simplify it for you. You can't provide every single solution via a quiz, right? There should always be a pathway in a quiz that splits people off if they have a more unique situation and pushes them through to like a lead form, where you say something like, based on your requirements, we need to give you a, you know, extra service. We need to give you a custom quote. We'd love to give you a call. Can you leave your name, your phone number, your email? We're going to get in touch with you in the next how many hours you can service them in. And they'll leave their details, and then you'll call them and have a chat to them about their needs. The quiz should really be providing the answers that the vast majority of people require. And if you think about it that way, that usually will cut down the amount of questions you need, because it's often some of the more wackier outcomes that not many people are actually interested in that can make the quiz challenging, coming up with the series of logic and questions to take people through. Now, in terms of questions, I would really try to keep it definitely less than 10. If you can get it to 5, that's fantastic. You know, it's not always possible. I've got one that runs at 3 to 5 and actually works. And that's good. But sometimes it needs to be more. But I think 10 is the limit for me. If you need to get to 10, then you need to work out how to simplify your quiz. Sometimes that can mean splitting your quiz. So, like, sometimes you'll try to make a quiz that covers multiple different types of products. And you might need to just separate, like have a quiz for one type of product and just put it on those pages. Have a quiz for another type of product and put it on those pages. Have another quiz. So you can have multiple quizzes on your site, right? Sometimes that's the answer as well. Other quiz little tips I can give you. I mean, I love these things. Other little tips that I can give you is put that email opt-in at the end, not the start. If you put it at the start, almost nobody will take your quiz. You put it at the end because once somebody's answered all the questions, they absolutely need to know the answer at that point. Their curiosity is going to overcome whether or not they want to give you their email address. And also test capturing phone numbers. So once again, in one of our businesses, we have somebody in that business who is fantastic at sales. Every quiz response, she contacts like immediately. And we're capturing phone numbers on this one. I mean, this is gold, literally. Think about it, phone numbers, right? You get somebody's phone number, you can call them straight away and have a chat to them about what they need. You've got their quiz answer. Okay, hey man, what can we do to get this sale across the line? You know, talk to them a bit more about their story, confirm that it's the right product. And this works. And when we ask for a phone number, I make it optional usually rather than required. We still get 50%+ of people leaving a phone number. Now, the numbers of where this can go can get quite staggering, right? Now, you know, if I calculated, you know, where we're going to go with this quiz on this particular site I'm thinking of, and, you know, over the course of 12 months, I calculated it out to, like, we'll be generating something like 4,000 phone numbers a month is where we could get to. Now, think about that. Think about having 4,000 numbers a month coming into your business that you could call. Of people who are interested in your product. And like, you know, they're interested in your products because they've been on your site looking at your stuff. And you know, you even know what product they're in that you recommended them. So you can get on the phone straight away. It's a super easy conversation. You know, at that point, and you know, by that point, we'll have a sales team making those calls. And it's going to crush it to the tune of millions of dollars. That's exciting. Like, I'm so pumped for that. And so this is where you can go with these things. So lead generation, spoiler alert, I'm probably going to say it on a podcast soon. Lead generation combined with Ben made a prediction about a talk he did at our live event last year in 2023 around content and things like that as being, and in a particular way, as being a big part of the future for these type of businesses. Well, that combined with a more traditional lead generation approach is also going to be the future of high ticket dropshipping for sure. Where we use sales teams to make high ticket sales. There are people that do this already. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we're doing it already. But for a lot of people, it's something that we're going to be talking about a lot more, which is not something that we talk a lot about right now. And so it's some interesting things coming up for sure. All right, moving along, questions. Thank you for that question. Miguel as well. I love quizzes. Thanks for letting me talk about them. The Lash 96. Hi, The Lash from YouTube. Hi, John. I'm having trouble getting accepted into Google Merchant Center due to website needs improvement. I have all my policies and requirements done. What are some small details people miss? Look, here's what I would say about this. And I've said it before. You may have that warning because there, or that suspension because there was something wrong with your site. You may have it because there's nothing wrong with your site. Now, if you think you've met all the requirements and that sort of thing, literally the thing that is going to get you unsuspended is hammering Google's support lines, whether it's email or phone. If you can find a phone number, sometimes you can, or just the email or the contact things with requests for help is going to get you unsuspended. Like, honestly, if I look in our student group for people who have had a suspension that have had it overturned, some of whom after months, some of whom after weeks, some of whom after a shorter time frame, the most common thing that people get is they just kept contacting Google until they got a helpful person who could help them. And oftentimes that helpful person looked at it and said, well, I can't see anything wrong here. Unsuspended. Right. Unfortunately, that's the reality that we live in right now. Hasn't always been the case. It's actually been the case for a very short period of time, relatively. But it is the case now is that Google is trying to rely on AI to run these processes in the first instance. And lo and behold, AI is far from perfect. And so there are also people in Google's organization who can't overturn AI suspensions, even if they see that there is, in fact, nothing really wrong here. Nothing to see here. Whereas other people can. And so when you contact Google, sometimes you get that person, sometimes you don't. So literally, I wish I had a magic bag of tricks I could pull out and just fix this for people. I really do, but I don't. Nobody on Fiverr does. None of the agencies that charge $3,000 or $4,000 for the service do either. And I know all their names, and I've heard of plenty of people who have paid them and got something, and plenty of people who have paid them that got nothing, which means it's pot luck. But the one thing that seems to have worked the most in these cases is just keeping on contacting Google, like daily. It's annoying. It's frustrating. It's energy sapping. I very much sympathize with the situation, but it is temporary. Everybody gets it overturned sooner or later. And you can still build a fantastic business without it. I bring up John Murphy. John Murphy's name a lot. One of our coaches at Dropship Breakthrough, a longtime friend, gave him a $10 million award at our Dropship Breakthrough Live last month. He had the longest Google suspension before it was even really a thing. For years he was suspended, still generated $10 million in revenue. No Google shopping, right? So you can still build a good business, but I would say the main thing is just keep hammering Google until you get a good answer out of them, or somebody who can actually help you and tell you what's wrong, if there even is anything wrong, which there may not be. You think you've got your dots, your T's crossed and your I's dotted, then you probably do, to be honest. And it's probably just that you're not getting the help you need there from Google. So keep hitting them up. Josh asks follow-up question. I have products that are similar but deserve separate product pages, not a variant on the same page. If I'm trying to build out descriptions, how can I make these sound different? Well, I would say that if your products are similar but deserve separate product pages, I mean, there must be something different about the products. So they must do something different for somebody, or provide a different version of an outcome or something like that. Like, if they can't be the same. So focus on the things that are different in your description to make your descriptions variable or different, right? Like, what is the outcome that they provide? Maybe they do something a little bit differently. Maybe they serve maybe one's a bigger version of another, and the big version serves a different customer to the smaller version, or it's better suited to a particular type of customer and an outcome than the smaller version. Or maybe this one's got two or three extra features on it compared to this one, but they look very similar. Whatever it is, like, focus on those things in your description. Like, if you've got one version that's suited to a particular type of person, have the first paragraph or two of your description talk about that. Talk about the outcome it provides and who it's ideally suited to and why it's ideally suited to that person and what's the mechanism it uses to do the thing that it does and all of that sort of thing. And, you know, use AI to help you a little bit. Like, you can use AI. You can use ChatGPT or Claude. Honestly, I think is probably from my practice at least, and I know Ben loves Claude, is probably a little bit better in this field at the moment than any of the others for description writing. Use those tools to help you come up with new angles or different ideas for sure. And then, you know, check them, read them, rewrite them a little bit if you need to. But yeah, that's probably what I'd do. Sometimes it's tough though, not gonna lie. Josh also says, also, I'm in Oz. Hope you're bringing back a live event again in the future. I don't know about Australia. I don't know when that's going to happen next. It might be it's something Ben and I are talking about. Are going to have an ongoing discussion about is what's our upcoming live event. It's going to look like. We've got some ideas, but they're not necessarily the same as things we've done in the past. And so stay tuned. It might be, there might be something in Australia. There might be something close to Australia. We've certainly thrown around some names like Bali and Thailand and some other places around the world as well. So we'll see. We'll see. There will be more of something though in the future for sure. So Jeff, follow-up question. I have an abandoned checkout flow, abandoned cart flow, and abandoned product page flow, but I don't have a pop-up that asks people to input their email. If I don't have that pop-up, am I still getting emails? Well, no. No, I mean, if you don't have any capture, email capture on your website, then no. You're not really getting any emails. Which is fine. Like you don't need to, like I say, until you're ready to actually do the proactive email marketing, you probably don't need to. I mean, if somebody buys from you, you're capturing their email. Of course, if somebody abandons a checkout, and they put their email in, you're capturing their email. So you're going to get some emails, but you're not going to get any real bulk of emails unless you put things on your site to proactively get people to enter their emails, whether that's a pop-up of some sort or a quiz or some other kind of lead magnet, as they're termed. Yeah. So no bucks, no whammies. I think has a question here. Launched my store in March, did 21K in revenue in May, and now barely making 5K. Nothing changed. Any suggestions? What month is it? It's July. August. Well, something changed somewhere. So I'd go back to an earlier answer I gave. There's something going on there. Do I have any suggestions? No. I mean, if I was going to help with a question like that, like some of the things I'm going to look at is, I'm going to look at your traffic, wherever that's coming from. I'm going to look at your website. I'm going to look at the competition within your niche, because maybe something changed there that you're not aware of. And, you know, I'm also going to ask the question, really between March and August, nothing's changed? Like, you haven't done anything at all? You should be doing a lot in that time. I think that there are a range of things I would be looking at there, but without looking at those things, I would be guessing. I couldn't say what it's going to be. It's not just new competitors. Like your competitors do things. They change what they do. No business just sits there and does the same thing day in, day out for years. That's a losing business. So that's what I say. Like, I mean, you've got to have a close look. There's obviously something going on there. Or maybe there's not. And really barely making 5K is the norm or the average, and the 21K was just an outlier. I mean, that's possible. Once again, talking about how to improve results past that kind of 5K mark. Well, yeah, there's a range of things to look at. But without actually pulling your business up on the screen and looking at your ad accounts and doing all that sort of thing, it's very difficult to hone in on anything in particular as to what you need to do to improve that. Certainly sort of help that we can provide in our membership and that sort of thing. But like literally, you know, you want me to do a live teardown on your business or something like that? I'm happy to do it, but I'm not gonna guess at what could be going on. Christine, hello, Christine asks, I'm extremely new to all of this and I'm struggling with niche selection. Is this common for many people? I just bought ChatGPT for assistance, but it has been a challenge for us both. Look, it's definitely a stage of the journey where uh, where people do get stuck. You know, it's easy to have a mental blank. It's easy to second guess what you're looking at. It's easy to get stuck in analysis paralysis and think you need to look at all sorts of data that you really don't need to look at. So, it's probably not unusual for people to get stuck there. So, I mean, don't feel bad about it. But at the same time, don't overthink it either. There's no, like I mentioned earlier, there's no secret niches or anything like that. Like, I've seen every niche known to man, like, honestly. Like, I mean, I've been doing verifying people's niches for many years now, thousands of times. And I know the people who are making the big money in this space and blah, 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 and none of it's secret stuff. Don't overthink it. Literally, come up with a few ideas. Christine, you're in our membership. You can throw them in for niche verification. Just throw some things in there. We'll see, but don't spend too much time on it. Do a bit of research, go online, find products that are high ticket, and throw some ideas in there. We'll see what happens. Jeff, but I do see a list of people that haven't bought from me. When I click on customers on my Shopify backend, it says subscribe. Are you sure I'm not collecting emails? Well, no, I'm not sure you're collecting emails. I haven't seen your website. Do you have a contact us form on your contact us page? Like the actual form thing where the people fill in a box and leave an email address? If you do have that, you've probably got email spam happening. Which would account for that. I wouldn't put a form on there. I've stopped doing that. I have a site, where this happened. I had the form on the Contact Us page, and it didn't have a recapture on it either, which was probably, it was an oversight. It was a site that I bought off somebody else, and I just hadn't paid any attention to it yet, really. And it got like, something like 50,000 emails subscribed. I don't even know what the point is, like, but it just got a flood of emails subscribed through that contact form. And we had like people emailing in saying, how am I on this email list? I didn't subscribe for this. And so I had to go through and delete them all, of course. And then I just took the form off the website. So if you've got a contact us page form, like not your email address written on the page, but like the actual form where people put in their name, their email, and then click send or something like that, you take that off. Like, you don't really need it. Those things are pretty pointless. Just put your email address on there, like your sales at whatever it is or info at whatever it is. Just put that on there. People can email you if they want. Or if you don't want to keep the form, put a recapture on it. That can help with that problem. Yes, take the contact us form off. See if that changes anything. But if you're seeing emails in there and you don't know where they came from and you didn't proactively put them there, I would delete them out of that customers area. Because if you, once again, if you start emailing those people, you might have a problem with people listing your domain as spam, which will affect you when you actually do try and proactively collect some email addresses and you want to start sending good messages to people. If you've been emailing people who don't know who you are or don't recognize your name because they didn't actually. Now, emails don't come from flows. The only way you get emails is by capturing emails in a form on your site. So once again, like I say, like you've got a pop-up that comes up that says, hey, enter your email and get a discount, which I don't recommend at all. That's a terrible pop-up, but a lot of people do it. Or you have a quiz on your website, like the Miguel's question earlier that I answered, or you have like a download thing, like enter your email, like somebody's on a blog post, enter your email for our handy checklist on how to do blah, 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 and you send them a download. That's how you get emails. They come from, or obviously when people buy from you or abandon checkout or something like that. Alrighty, that wraps up the Q&A. Thank you. If you made it this far in, wow, that was a long episode. That's longer than we normally do here. I think that came in at about an hour and 40 minutes or so. Thanks for hanging out. I hope you enjoyed the answer to those questions. As I mentioned earlier, look, if you have questions and you're on Spotify, there's an area around the episode that you can leave those questions. We'd love to come back to them in a future episode. If you're on YouTube, please leave a comment, leave a question as a comment, and we will absolutely answer it here. And look, of course, if you're ready to start your high-ticket dropshipping business, if you're ready to get something up and running in the next month, then join Dropship Breakthrough today. Just head to dropshipbreakthrough.com/join. The link is below the episode. As soon as you sign up there, you'll have instant access to everything in the course and all the support you'll ever need. And you will certainly fast track your journey towards growing a profitable high ticket dropshipping business. Until next time, see ya.
Thanks for listening to the Dropship Podcast. You can find all the show notes for this episode at dropshippodcast.com. And if you're ready to take the next step in your dropshipping journey, we invite you to join us inside Dropship Breakthrough, where John and I will walk you through step-by-step in starting your own high-ticket dropshipping e-commerce business. But that's not all. Dropship Breakthrough will also teach you everything you'll need to know to grow your business and take it to the next level. So head over to dropshipbreakthrough.com and sign up for our free training that will help you take the first steps towards building and growing your own profitable high-ticket dropshipping business. John and I both love business, think about it all the time, can't turn it off, and don't know why anyone would want to. And because of that, we started a second podcast where we can talk about everything we've ever wanted to talk about in business, not just dropshipping. We like talking about all things business. So if you want to hear John and I talk about all sorts of stuff, from camel meat dropshipping businesses to PDF dropshipping to a guy gambling $100 every single day on YouTube Shorts, to how OnlyFans taught us lessons in business. We're all over the place over there, but it's a really fun podcast. So if you're a podcast listener, you love John and I, head over to your podcast player of choice and look for the Low Bar Podcast. You'll see a blue image and you'll see a cartoon version of John and myself. And go back and start at episode one. I promise you will not regret this. This is one of the more fun projects that I have done recently. I know John's having fun too, so we'd love it if you joined us. Check out the Low Bar Podcast on YouTube or wherever you prefer to listen to podcasts.